Welcome to the Security Perimeter Podcast, an island of insanity, starring my dad, Athanasios Christoulos. This is an amazing podcast, really the best. You're gonna love this, guaranteed, 100%. We are gonna make podcasting great again, promise. And now, my dad, Athanasios, aka Saki Christoulos.
I hear the drums echoing tonight. She hears only whispers of some quiet conversation. She's coming in 12:30 flight. The moonlit wings reflect the stars that guide me towards salvation. I stopped an old man along the way, hoping to find some old.
We'll begin the podcast in a second. This week's guest is Dr. Cecilia Farfán, who will be talking about drug trafficking organizations in Mexico. But before we get to the interview, just a couple of announcements. Number one, it's becoming increasingly more difficult to produce these things on a weekly basis, given other commitments. So I think I'm going to change format now and try to put them out every 10 days or so. That's announcement number one. And announcement number 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 is please, if you like the podcast, please say so. Send me an email. The email for the podcast is perimeterpodcast@gmail.com. Like us on Facebook. Like us on the podcast page. Share our podcast. I'd like to increase our listening audience as much as possible. This is starting to catch on. It's an upward curve, but I'd like to see that curve go up even more. I'm having a great time doing this. I hope everybody who listens to this is also enjoying the podcast. I'm learning a lot, and I hope that you are too. So we'll take another quick little musical break, and we'll get on to the interview with Dr. Cecilia Farfán on drug trafficking organizations in Mexico and how to deal with them. So today's guest is Dr. Cecilia Farfán, who just recently finished her PhD at the University of California in Santa Barbara. And she did her PhD thesis on drug trafficking organizations and how they're structured, how they operate. And her central argument in the thesis is that by knowing this, you can understand how to defeat these DTOs in a more successful and more efficient manner. Ceci is a former student of ITAM. She was my assistant for a couple of years. And in spite of that, she did something with her life and went on to do this PhD in California. So Ceci, it's so great to see you.
No, thank you so much for having me. I'm thrilled of being here.
How did you get into that topic? Because I remember when we were working together, you were sort of into security, but not really into security.
Right. Well, it was... So the first 2 years of the PhD, as you know, you spend a lot of time in seminars, mm-hmm. right? Taking classes, reading a lot, and really trying to deconstruct arguments of somebody else, right?
Oh, someone she used the word deconstruction.
Someone who spent a lot of time thinking about an article, and then you think about the ways of, you know, what's wrong with this paper. So all the time you're thinking about arguments. And when I was in that period, it was also a time where a lot of reporting of violence came out. This is around 2011, 2012,
right,
where violence levels really reached high levels in the country. So reading the news, I would see, you know, there would be different news analyses of these organizations, and sometimes they would talk about, you know, different things that they would observe, but no one was really putting, you know, sort of this difference, they didn't seem to matter or transcend anything. It was more about, oh, the cartel did this and this cartel did that. Mm-hmm. But to me, it started to come out, well, it doesn't seem that they are all that similar, and this probably matters. And so
that different cartels were different.
Right, these different organizations. I don't call them cartels, but these different organizations.
DTOs.
Exactly. And I started reading about them even more, you know, through journalistic accounts. And then I started doing some preliminary interviews. And I was like, well, you know, my hunch is that they are different. Is this the case? And so the answers from that were yes. And then I pursued the topic more seriously.
Okay. I know that you did interviews with law enforcement officials on both sides of the border.
Right.
And did you actually get a chance to speak to any members of DTOs?
No, I did not.
Okay, I'll take that out then. That would have been cool. That would have been a cool story. Okay, so Ceci, before we actually get into your argument about how to deal with drug trafficking organizations and what they look like and so forth, like I told you before, about half our listeners are from outside of Mexico, so a lot of them are going to be interested in knowing what Mexico looks like in terms of these organizations. So if you can give us a bit of a descriptive introduction to what's going on in Mexico, what's been going on in Mexico, how the strategy has evolved and on the part of the government.
So Mexico holds a strategic position in relation to the largest market for illegal drugs, which is the U.S. So we share a pretty long border, and the position that Mexico has that makes it a very interesting place for drug trafficking to take place. And these became particularly the case after the U.S. closed what's known as the Caribbean Route.
Right.
So basically the Colombians using the Caribbean to move drugs, you know, through Florida.
Yeah, with those fast boats. I remember I was in the 80s with, what was that show called?
Miami Vice.
Yeah, yes. Yeah, all right.
So once that route became much more limited and restricted, then Mexico became a much more interesting partner to move drugs for Colombians, right? Mm-hmm. So that's a period that some journalists and some academics call the Mexican Springboard.
That's in really the 90s, when it, right?
Right. Well, actually earlier,
maybe
in the 80s. So you have that moment when they become more central. And now what you have is different organizations, some that are more interested in drug trafficking and traffic imported drugs, either from Colombia or Peru, and by that I mean cocaine mostly. And they also move locally produced drugs, heroin, synthetic drugs. And then you have other organizations that may also move cocaine, but not necessarily purchased in Colombia and Peru, but from Central American partners, you know, the freelance market that we see. Now that's not as common, and you know, they don't move that much, you know, cocaine through that method, but you also see that taking place in Mexico.
Is any cocaine grown in Mexico, like in, you know, the highlands of Veracruz, for example?
I don't know that we have accurate data for that. I wouldn't necessarily say no, but mm-hmm. I would say that the one that's sold mostly in the U.S. mm-hmm. is from Colombia or Peru, depending on who's, you know, producing more at a given time.
So Mexico produces
heroin,
pot,
yes,
ecstasy,
yeah, synthetic drugs. Yes, it produces more mm-hmm. illegal drugs than any other known sources. So in terms of the wide array that we see, yeah, you know, sort of the Mexico has more than that, than other countries that may focus on one particular kind of drug.
Oh, okay. I didn't know that. The Mexican government started a war, and I'm doing my quotation marks with my fingers, against drugs under the Calderon administration. Why at that moment in time?
I think there's a lot of debate in terms of why that happened, policy-wise. What we do know is that during his campaign, he was employment president, right? He did not campaign on a platform of security. Mm-hmm. So we do know that that was not necessarily the intention. But what we do know is that once it happened, it was not necessarily executed properly. And this is because the intelligence that the government had was not necessarily the best. And this has to do with the fact that before the Calderon administration, so during the Fox administration, CISEN, which is the National Security Agency, right?
The equivalent. The intelligence, yeah.
Exactly. It didn't receive a lot of budget from the government. So it was decimated in terms of human capital and other resources. So the intelligence, even the one that they, you know, they had intelligence that was coming from the U.S. government, but the intelligence that was produced locally was perhaps not the best because of this institutional weakness that they faced. So, you know, the strategy that was followed, you know, was built perhaps on really weak, you know,
foundations,
exactly.
Yeah, just go in, bring the guns.
Right.
Yeah.
And, you know, I don't necessarily know that they expected that the response would be that of some of these organizations, and also that some of the conflicts between these organizations would be so lethal.
Yeah, it has been nasty, right? Over 100,000 dead since the beginning of this thing, about, what is it now, almost 10? Yeah, 10
yeah.
years. Yeah.
Yes, exactly.
100,000 dead. Could you tell us a little bit about the different cartels in Mexico? I mean, I know you're going to tell us what they look like internally in a moment, but again, for the people who are not familiar with what's going on in Mexico, you don't like me using the word cartel. how many drug trafficking organizations, where are they? I know they're fragmented and you're going to say literally thousands, but I know at the same time that there are a number of key ones throughout the country.
So the ones I research are the ones that are recognized by the U.S. Foreign Kingpin Designation Act, which basically is a U.S. act that tells you who is a significant player in the drug trafficking world.
Like an organization or a person?
Because
Kingpin is about...
Right, but this organization. So the ones that have been designated under that are the ones that I look at.
Okay.
Now, in the case of Mexico, we had the Arellano Felix organization, which is also known as the Tijuana organization, was part of that. Now they are not as strong. Then we have the Sinaloa organization. Beltran Leyva was in that at one point, but that's, again, difficult to assess how exactly it happened. Juarez, Zetas Golfo, La Familia, Caballeros Templarios. But again, how the influence that they have, it fluctuates over time, right? So at any given time, maybe you were designated, but it doesn't necessarily mean that you hold the same degree of power over time.
So it's a little messy to try to come up with a list of...
Absolutely. I mean, I think if you want the ultimate list of, like, you know, February 2017, how many do we have?
Yeah.
I think it's very difficult to come up
with that. All right, well, how about looking at it this way? How about looking at it in terms of violence? Certain states have been hit with violence more than other states in the country. And the reason is because these states are sort of like choke points, right? They're rallying points for the drugs to be moved out and shipped into the United States. What are the states most affected by violence? And is it because of this fact that there's some kind of, they're like a choke point in the transit of drugs across the U.S. border?
I mean, interestingly, of course, border points matter, and they're not all equally valuable, right? Even if you have, despite all the border crossings that we have, they're not equally valuable because you're going to want to use the ones that's the busiest as opposed to the one that's empty, right? Because then the likelihood of being caught is slower. You know, assuming that you're moving drugs that way, you know, there may be other ways that you are trafficking them into the U.S. But so, yes, we have these cities that matter, like Laredo, Juarez, Tijuana. So Michoacán is a central player to the extent that it houses the largest port in the country where chemical precursors used for producing synthetic drugs come into the country.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of the manufacture, so according to the United Nations Office on Drug and Crime, most of the synthetic drugs produced in North America, so Canada, US, and Mexico, are produced in Mexico. So there's, you know, there's a lot of production taking place there.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, there's competition for that market.
You were talking, before I interrupted you with the Michoacán thing, you were about to say something about these choke points along the border.
Right, so you definitely have violence in those areas, but again, the violence in these cities has changed, right? So Juarez experienced really bad violence in 2010, 2011, but now it's not one of the top states. In fact, Colima is one of the top states in the list right now in terms of homicides. Now, having said that, still understanding violence, it's also pretty difficult. Despite having these statistics on homicides and extortion and kidnappings, the reality is that most people in Mexico do not report crimes because they don't believe the state, you know, will do anything about it. So we're talking about less than 10% of the crimes being reported. So even what we observed is really little. To the extent that you see, oh, okay, there's a lot happening, you know, there's a lot of violence. There's a lot also that we're not necessarily seeing, especially, you know, from Mexico City, like looking into the rest of the country. There's stuff that we're missing. And that's just the nature of really not knowing and people not reporting other violence, right? Because you think of homicide and that's lethal violence, and that may be something used by the DTOs, but it may not be the only thing. These individuals may experience violence in other ways that it's clearly affecting their lives, and we're really not having a good gauge on how that works.
A big debate in this country is why Mexico City has been relatively safe throughout all of this. There's a bunch of arguments out there, and it is getting worse in the last year, actually.
Right.
Things are not as good as they were a few years ago in the city. But what's your take on why Mexico City hasn't been or hadn't been affected?
It's also not clear to me. You know, I'd rather, you know, to make my, to construct, you know, my research, I'd rather
don't
have
say the word
more
construct.
To build my research, I'd rather have information that,
yeah,
even
okay,
if it's small,
come on, Ceci,
I'm getting
but you
there.
Can, all right.
I don't know if it's because you have the existence of a lot of smaller organizations that have clear control over pockets of the city. You know, that you have very strong unions, right? Of, sorry, like the illegal taxi cabs that operate. And they
you
have
mean Uber?
No, I don't mean Uber. But, you know, they have a stronghold over that. And the amount of people that you have. I don't know how that plays a factor into that, and that it's not necessarily, you know, a production center like other areas of the country. Now, it is getting worse. Like, we are seeing that. So the idea that this is sort of a, oh, nothing can happen in Mexico City except for the violence that we already experience, you know, through petty theft or, you know, auto theft or, you know, these express kidnappings. It's not clear to me. And again, the influence maps published by different organizations have different ideas on what's going on in Mexico City. And so I don't really think we have a good explanation, but it may have to do with the fact that you already have other illegal organizations that are not necessarily the big organized crime that are already operating in parts of the city.
It is interesting to note, however, that even though with this uptick, this recent uptick in violence in the city, that Mexico City is still a lot safer than many U.S. cities. New Orleans, for example, is considered a more dangerous city in terms of world rankings.
Right.
Chicago has been hit really hard recently. I suspect Oakland isn't a particularly safe city compared to Mexico City. But I mention this because, like I said before, a lot of our listeners are from the United States, and I want to highlight this point that there are other places in the world that are dangerous, and some of them are actually in the United States.
No, absolutely. And to add to that, we also have to keep in mind that these are businessmen. You know, large organized criminal organizations also make decisions based on cost and benefit.
Right.
And so if I'm one of the organizations that sells drugs in the U.S. and that's my main business, being violent towards the population, it's not good for my business because I'm attracting attention of law enforcement. I don't need that. I don't need unwanted attention. If I'm moving drugs, I need discretion. I need smart people who keep a low profile. I mean, if we think of characters who have been, or individuals who have been involved in the business for a long time, they're not flashy. They're not, you know, they're not out there for everyone. They don't necessarily engage in these other more predatory violence, not because they're necessarily good people or out of a, you know, altruism. It's just not good for business to be attracting law enforcement attention while at the same time I'm trying to move drugs.
Very good point, Ceci. To clear up, what do you mean by predatory violence?
I mean, to me, the predatory violence is that the one that targets civilians, of people who would not be directly involved with the drug business.
Okay.
So if I target you, but you're one of my rivals, then that would not consist of predatory violence. But if I'm just a citizen and then all of a sudden I'm being extorted by one of these organizations, then that's different. Then that would be a predatory.
Okay. Okay, so let's move on to your argument. Very interesting argument you've developed on the structure of these organizations and how it's necessary to know what they look like in order to be able to defeat them.
Okay. So what I actually do is not necessarily look at policy, you know, like what the state does and how DTOs react, but I look at DTOs as organizations in themselves.
Okay.
So how are they structured and why does this matter, you know? And so the idea is to try to, instead of thinking of them as, you know, like unitary, homogeneous actors, say, well, you know, they actually are not that similar to one another. And Mexico is a good case to study them because, you know, they have the same shock. You know, they experience the war on drugs, but they respond to it in different ways. And so what I do is look more at how they act internally, you know, how they launder money, why they use some violence, you know. So like one of your questions is like why some places are worse than others. Yeah, and so like one of the answers, not like fully obviously but partially, is that they have different business models that lead some to use this predatory violence, like extortion and kidnapping become attractive criminal activities.
So is there a typology of them?
So basically it's this, like, the type of drug that you traffic is going to determine the type of structure that you prefer. So imported drugs like cocaine and heroin are going to have a more hierarchical structure, and then manufactured ones will have more of a network type structure. Now, once the structure
So you said imported, more hierarchical, whereas locally produced stuff,
less hierarchical, like more networked.
More networked.
So hierarchies are good because...
Why would that be? But before you tell me why it's good or bad, why would that be the case?
You need to develop a lot more trust with your suppliers when you import drugs, because from indictments, what we know is that drugs, when I import drugs, I don't pay them when I get them. You know, I pay for them once I sell them in the U.S. So there's a lot of fronting in the business. So... Okay. What happens is like there's a lot of delayed.
You want to explain fronting, because a lot of Mexicans are going to listen to this. So
basically you send me something and I'm not paying for it right away. Mm-hmm. So I'm just giving it to you until you sell it, then you pay me.
Right.
So that would be fronting. So then what happens is that you need to develop a lot of trust, because these transactions don't take place. Like, I don't buy cocaine from you and pay you right away. And so we know from indictments, you know, from these accusations in the U.S. that that's actually the case, that they wait and they develop these trustful relationships with their suppliers. I mean, in the most extreme cases, they
in
have
in
even...
In Colombia, for example,
exactly.
Right? Okay.
So in the most extreme cases, they have even produced marriages, you know, between Colombians and Mexicans.
Cool.
So...
Cool. They have resulted in weddings, which ultimately... In typical mafia format.
I mean, that's the ultimate
strengthens,
trust.
Strengthens the bond, right?
Right. So by hierarchy, I also do not mean that there's one person deciding everything. It's more that you have a lot of grooming taking place within the structure. So you have people who are teaching you the business, right? Like, you learn from your manager, and the manager will delegate to you because they want to do other things, right?
Mm-hmm.
But I also... You know, we don't get paid until the drugs are sold in the U.S., you know, even though there's internal consumption. But the real business is selling in the U.S., right? So until that happens, none of us is getting the benefit of being a criminal. So I'm going to make sure that I select, you know, I'm groom the right people for the business.
Makes sense.
So you acquire a lot of information on who you're dealing with through that process.
Presumably... On the other end as well, right? In the delivery stage,
right? I mean, but that's
in the U.S.
But that's a wholesale business, right? Like, you sell that to someone who's a wholesale buyer, and then they'll do the retail level. But that's not
So you wouldn't see those kind of linkages at that level between Mexican?
You might. I mean, I think there is a lot of division of labor on the other side, but it's really here where they, in Mexico, where they have more control of what's happening.
Okay, so which are the cartels that import-export?
I mean, Sinaloa is more involved, so the Sinaloa organization. And what I mean by that, and this is not necessarily the name they use, but the name that has given to them by law enforcement, mm-hmm. They are definitely cocaine buyers from Colombia or Peru.
Okay, so, and have you seen that they have a tendency to be less violent?
They do. It doesn't mean that they're not capable of lethal violence. They are very much capable of using extreme violence, but they use it selectively. And by that, I mean they will use it against rivals, and mm-hmm. they will use it against the state, but they don't necessarily use it against people. Mm-hmm. And especially in their own state, if there's, you know, if they're producing drugs, because you also don't want to mistreat those who work for you.
Right, but the ones who work for them are actually in Colombia and Peru.
Right, but you also have heroin production in Mexico. So the opium cultivation is placed here.
Okay, so on the other end, you got the local
local
producers, and you're arguing that they're much more fragmented or network-based.
Right.
Much more likely to use violence.
Right.
You want to
explain
that whole hypothesis there?
Absolutely. So basically, there's two things. One thing is that in the 90s, the preference for cocaine started to shift. So drug consumers didn't necessarily want to consume cocaine the same way that it happened in the 70s and the 80s. And so what we see from documents produced by the United Nations Office on Drugs and Crime is that, in fact, the preference from these synthetic type drugs went up. And part of it is the perception that they're not as bad for you as heroin and cocaine, right? So drugs like ecstasy became far more popular in the 90s than cocaine was. So in order to produce that, then you don't need to develop trust, right? Because if you can manufacture that locally, you don't really need to worry about who's making it for you. You just need to worry about having someone who's good at making it. So I'm going to try to hire a good, say, meth cook, but I'm not necessarily concerned with having trust with that person. And the other thing is, like,
really?
Yeah.
I mean,
you don't necessarily, I'm not saying you don't trust him or her at all. I'm just saying, like, you don't need the kind of trust that happens when someone is fronting your business.
Okay, fair enough, because you're paying on the spot.
Exactly.
For starters, right?
And I hire you to do this one job, right? Like, and then if you don't work out, I can replace you. Arguably, of course, the pool is not infinite. I cannot just find anyone to do it, but I will find someone, mm-hmm. you know, if I'm not happy with what you're doing. And so in that sense, the problem is that networks do not, because they hire for expertise mm-hmm. and do not groom people, like if I hire you to be a hitman, that's all you're going to be within my structure. So now you don't really have incentives, you know, for long-term participation. You just have incentives, you know, like, okay, I'm already in this criminal life. Let me see what else I can get out of this. And so you see extortion and kidnapping and this kind of predatory violence taking place in areas in Mexico where these types of organizations operate. Now, is this the only thing that explains violence? No, but do I believe that it partially accounts for the different types of violence that we see across the country? Yes.
Which are the cartels that are the local producers and...
So set this change how things happen. And, you know, for those who know a little bit more, they know that they did not start as a drug trafficking organization, but they started working for the Golfo organization as bodyguards, right? Mm-hmm. There were this specialized force that was going to take care of that business. Now, the thing is that Golfo never really transitioned from a family business to a full-blown large operation. It was in the process of doing that, but then things happened with their partners in Colombia. Things happened here in Mexico where top management was arrested.
Mm-hmm.
And so it never really transitioned to a more sophisticated operation. I mean, of course, it was large enough, but it was not...
Golfo or Zetas?
Golfo.
Okay.
So then when that happened, Zetas didn't really have the incentives to try to recover Golfo's former glory days. They were like, okay, we have a reputation for violence, we can use this, right? And they were more concerned about territory than the actual drug business. And so they started taxing local criminals. So I would take over a city, right? And then find out who the criminals were. And now the criminals were having to pay me in order to keep doing their criminal activities. And so what you see is that they change how they operate. And another trait about these wheel networks is that they're very fragile. And so La Familia actually fragmented from Los Zetas, and now Caballeros Templarios fragmented from La Familia. And it's very likely that in the next 2 years, we see that fragmentation taking place again, you know, at the risk of belaboring the point, but it has to do with the lack of these long-term incentives within these organizations.
People are going to be interested in what kinds of DTOs, what kind of violence do they prefer? Can you speak to that?
Well, I mean, I would say the DTOs that are wheel networks use predatory violence. So that means that they will extort the population where they are. They will kidnap them.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, in your previous podcast about the one where you talked to Seoane, who is a hostage negotiator, and he discusses kidnappings, he tells you, you know, it's a crime that offers you, you know, a sort of a high pay, low risk, you know, if you're not going to get caught. And this is exactly what you see with some of these DTOs. These guys were already involved in criminal activities, mm-hmm. but also engaged in kidnapping, the express kidnapping,
mm-hmm.
Because, you know, it's another income source. And really the risk of getting caught is not that high, especially in areas where the state is not that powerful or respected
by the population. That's what I was going to ask you. Does geographic location play a factor here? Are you more likely to see, for example, the network type organizations in the south as opposed to the more hierarchical types in the northern part of the country?
I mean, absolutely. I mean, to the extent that these synthetic drugs are produced in the country, and Lázaro Cárdenas in Michoacán is a port where the chemical precursors are, you know, that's where they enter the country. So that area...
For non-Mexicans?
In the state of Michoacán.
Okay.
Along the Pacific.
In the Pacific.
Yes. So...
Coming from China.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So geography, you know, in Michoacán and Guerrero, again, along the Pacific, matters for that. So, of course, there is an explanation related to drug routes. Now, if we wanted to map areas mm-hmm. of influence of these organizations, it becomes increasingly harder. And actually, if you compare data from Mexico and data produced from the Drug Enforcement Administration in the mm-hmm. U.S., they don't really correlate that much. There are times where, you know, they may have some organizations that are the same in a state, but they will claim that, you know, for example, the DEA will say, oh, there's 10 organizations operating in this state, and Mexican information would say there's two.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, over time...
Who's screwing up? Neither. Both.
I mean, I just think it's very hard to, if you're not thinking about the hubs of operation, like if you're not thinking of Sinaloa or Tamaulipas or Michoacán, it's much more difficult to really try to establish where they are, and especially at the municipal level, to try to determine that. Because they're also fluid, right? They may be in an area at one point, but they may move,
mm-hmm.
you know, as part of, if they take down a cell, that's not necessarily bad for the network in its entirety, it's just bad for that particular cell.
Okay, so network type organizations are much more likely to survive a cell being taken down than, let's say, a hierarchical type organization.
Now, having said that, is this kingpin strategy that the Mexican and the U.S. government have pursued.
Okay.
So this idea that I'm going to take out the leader of an organization
mm-hmm.
and then that will disrupt the whole operation, that's not really something that we find is supported in the evidence that we have.
Why would that? I would think in the hierarchical ones, it would make that kind of kingpin strategy would make more sense.
See, there is a short-term disruption for sure. But if you remember, I was just telling you there's a lot of grooming process taking place within that organization.
Ah, yes.
So you have members who know the know-how. Like, what do you do when, you know, there's a shipment that gets lost? What do you do when if it gets stolen?
Mm-hmm.
And so in that sense, there is a lot of preparation within the organization
redundancy
of what to do. Exactly. So in my interviews with U.S. and Mexican government officials, they will acknowledge that there is a short-term disruption, but it doesn't go past that. And then with networks, by definition, you don't really have a kingpin because you have this sort of shared control, you know, over the network and shared decision-making. So to the extent that we keep pursuing kingpin strategies, it also encourages new organizations to have this wheel network type structure that are more unstable, tend to be more violent, and are not really disrupted by this policy.
So what do you do?
I mean, I think from my research, you have to take a step back, and even though if you think of them, are they all criminals? The answer is yes. Are they all the same? The answer is no.
Mm-hmm.
And so you first have to take that step back and say, okay, how do they operate? You know, why? How do they choose the partners that they have? You know, how do they choose to launder money? You know, in wheeled networks, we see that they choose methods that are not very sophisticated, but at the same time, they don't launder a lot of money. So the question is it worth it to go after that money? Perhaps not so much, because if they're not laundering that much, is that really where your resources should be?
Okay, so back up for a second here, because you're an expert on this. And first, you're saying targeting the individuals doesn't make sense because they go into the business for different reasons and different motivations. Is that right?
Right.
Okay. The second thing you're saying is that you need to target the actual method rather than the person. Is that
right?
Is that right?
Exactly.
Okay.
So if you start thinking
so
of
if
that, we're,
if you and the case that you looked at was money laundering,
one of the cases.
Okay.
Yes.
So go back now. What were you saying before?
So basically, what we see is that because they're not structured in the same way and they have different incentives, you will find that they will launder money differently. They will even punish people within the organization differently. And that matters because that reveals you a lot of their behavior. So again, going back to the money laundering, maybe tracking a hierarchical organization and how they do it is far more costly because they tend to have more sophisticated money laundering practices. Mm-hmm. But if you're able to get it, if you're able to track it, then you will take down a significant portion. You know, you will be able to take down not a small amount. With wheel networks, it may be easier to find where their money is, but it may not be that much. So trade-offs all the time, of course, because the state has limited resources, you know, in terms of choosing what to do. And so to the extent that you think of them as different, as structured in different ways and having different incentives, then you'll probably be able to design policies that really target the weaknesses of each structure instead of this sort of like one size fits all approach that we followed for the last 10 years.
10 years or so. So different organizations will have different weaknesses. You need to identify those weaknesses, particular weakness. Is money laundering something that's consistently a sore spot for these organizations? In other words, something that the state can attack? Or is there other things that that can be done?
I mean, money laundering is a useful area to target because you're targeting the resources, right, that they have. And so, and that's not necessarily a minor thing, especially if you're able to take down. Now, it's not necessarily simple, and it does require a lot of cooperation, you know, especially with the U.S. government or other governments, you know, because these investigations take time and, you know, they go across borders most of the time. But when you are able, you know, to take out resources, I think that's more valuable than taking out individuals or, you know, thinking, oh, this individual is no longer part of the organization. This will definitely have a long-term effect.
We've got a problem on the money laundering issue, though, which is corruption. It's prevalence and participation on the part of the prevalence and participation on the part of authorities and in the whole money laundering or the money issue. You're saying to target the money laundering, right?
Right.
Mexican law enforcement or authorities are involved. How useful would that strategy be?
But I don't know that authorities would be necessarily involved in the process, as you I mean, because you're thinking more, if you're thinking more about law enforcement, that's a different kind of involvement, right? But for money laundering, my ultimate goal, if I'm a criminal, is that I want to be able to use that money, right? The idea is that I cannot spend it because I have to prove that the origin is not one of criminal activities.
Mm-hmm.
It's just about learning how they operate, right? Mm-hmm. And again, it goes back to seeing, oh, they have different schemes on how they do it. So the HSBC case.
Could you tell us about that?
Yes. So basically, HSBC ended up having to sign a deferred prosecution agreement with the U.S. government, right? Because they violated a number of, you know, sanctions that the U.S. has vis-a-vis other governments and, you know, other states. And they also launder money for Mexican organizations. So it was a host of different scenes, one of which was laundering money for Mexican organizations, also Colombian ones. So what happened there is it was the organization using the bank and the resources available within the bank to do the money laundering, but there were no authorities really involved in the sense of government authorities involved in the laundering. So of course the compliance levels of the bank were not good. One of the senators during the hearing actually called it the school of low banking expectations.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, it was really the lack of compliance within the bank that decided to accept higher levels of risk
that the DTO was able to take advantage of.
Exactly.
So targeting violence, bringing them down, you know, deploying soldiers, for you isn't the answer.
No.
It's
not long term.
Right.
Absolutely.
It's, and focus on bringing these organizations down after identifying what kind of organization they are, what their money laundering structure is, and adapt a policy specifically, adapt an anti-money laundering policy specifically to that particular organization.
I mean, I wouldn't say you wouldn't focus on violence right now because, of course, there's casualties and very real
obviously,
ones.
Yeah.
What I do think is that, you know, this one-size-fits-all approach is really, it has proven over a decade that it's not the most effective one. So what you want to do by thinking of them as different organizations is that will allow you to then limit their activities. I don't think that you can ever get rid of them because as long as there's a demand for these products, there will be someone willing to supply it.
Mm-hmm.
But what you can do is really contain their activities. I mean, you'll know that there'll be some level of criminal activity taking place because there's a demand for these drugs.
And Mexico has the right geography for it. And
right. Like, the U.S. is the largest market in the world.
Right.
So there's an incentive there,
mm-hmm.
an economic incentive, and there's economic opportunity, and there's profit to be made for sure. So you will definitely have actors who are willing to participate. Now, what's different today than a few years ago, and this is not to say that the war on crime is the sole culprit, but it definitely created the conditions for a market for protection to exist. And what is a market for protection? So say, you know, you and I have a contract, but I don't trust you. Say you're gonna sell me your car. But I don't trust you that after I give you the money, you're going to give me your car. And you don't necessarily trust me that I'm going to give you the full amount, right? And so in a state where you have rule of law, we can go to the courts, right, and have that contract enforced. Like if you don't comply, I can go to the courts and, you know, say, hey, he didn't comply with the contract. But if that's not the case, if we don't have that situation, then we have the existence of a market for protection. And that this is a concept that comes from what we saw in Italy with the mafia, growing and expanding. So what happens is that then we need someone who is going to provide that trust, right? So it's not necessarily the state who's enforcing the contract, but it's a third party, right, that will come in and make sure that you and I are complying with what we said we will. So now we have this situation where if you have, when the state comes in with the full force of the army, and tries to show, you know, oh, I can overpower these organizations, but that's not what happened, right? These organizations fought back, and in some cases, the state didn't really look so great in terms of the monopoly of the use of force. So now, if you had a situation where there was this societal trust that was lacking in the state, this situation where, you know, the armed forces, you know, didn't look amazing vis-a-vis, you know, these organizations, now you have even less trust in the state. And so what happens then is that, okay, I am not necessarily happy.
Matters worse.
Yeah, so I'm not necessarily happy to pay extortion money, but I will, because what other choice do I have, right? Mm-hmm. I cannot go and complain to the courts because I don't trust that they will do their job, right? And then I have this guy who's showing a lot of muscle, right, and a lot of firepower. And so in that case, I'm, you know, I'm not a happy customer, but I'm a willing customer. And so what you have now in some areas in the country is this market for protection that exists where people will pay this money. And again, not because they want to, but there isn't really a clear choice that they cannot do it.
So you're saying Calderon was wrong? It's all right. You can do it. Or you can tell us where he was right and where he was wrong.
I mean, I think it will take longer to make that kind of assessment in terms of where he was right and where he was wrong.
She's being careful not to get herself into trouble.
But I will say is that we do have enough evidence to show that these sort of strong arm, you know, firepower, army versus, you know, organized crime has proven to not be the most effective way to approach this problem. So it is a good time to start rethinking about how we conceive security, how we think of organized crime.
Well, I'm glad you said that because I wanted to ask you about the Nueva Ley de Seguridad Interna, the new Mexican law on internal security. It's not public security, it's not national security, it's internal security.
Right.
What do you think of that?
I don't think...
Can you describe it? I mean, I can describe it a little bit. I'm a foreigner, so I'm a little scared to describe it.
You should go ahead.
The thing that worries me about the Ley de Seguridad Interna is, well, I mean, that it's giving, from my understanding, the fight to the army and the armed forces of the country. It's basically saying that, you know, the Policía Federal failed and that we're going to give the fight back to the army and the navy, and when necessary we're going to implement, you know, state of emergencies in different cities or different states and so forth to respond to the violence.
I mean, I share your concern in terms of thinking that the armed forces are not designed for public safety, right? Which is different to national security, right? And so the idea right now, if we look at the victimization survey conducted by INEGI, so the Statistics Institute in Mexico, and the Army and the Navy have the highest levels of trust among other institutions. But that's not necessarily something that will sustain over long term, especially as there's this evidence of human rights violations, right? Because the way a policeman will relate to, you know, a crime committed is different.
Oh, I understand. No, I get that. But the thing is that, you know, after 10 years of this, you saw a drop in trust levels, especially with the Army around 2008, 2009.
Right.
But then it's back up again. I think maybe public opinion is looking around and saying, well, they're bad, so I'm going to give a high score to anybody that I can give one to, which is the Army and the Navy. I'm worried that people are putting too much trust in the armed forces.
I mean, we take a step back. When they were first utilized, it was under the assumption that we had to clean the police.
Right, the Policía Federal.
That it was a temporary intervention.
Until the PF was ready.
Exactly.
Right.
And I do still believe that we need to solve the issues of a federal police and a local police. I don't think you can operate without them and just have the Army or the Navy intervene, you know, within the perception of like, oh, this is not working, so they should come and take care of the problem. Because that's, again, not thinking of the long-term solution. That seems more like a patch, you know, than thinking, okay, we really need to develop, you know, a police that people trust. Now, the problem that we see in some areas is that young men and women do not want to join these police forces.
Right.
So recruitment is a challenge. Now, should that be the reason we don't pursue and don't have policemen? Of course not. We still need to work on that. Is that going to happen overnight? Definitely not. But you know, deep institutional changes require time. I can see how if you live in a place that has experienced tremendous violence, it would be appealing to say, oh, well, just let the army handle it. They seem to be the most efficient ones.
Mm-hmm.
But that's not really the direction that you want to go when you specifically think about public safety and, again, national security. You don't want them involved in that.
So you don't expect particularly good things to come out of this ley de seguridad. In terms of, forget about the human rights issues or martial law stuff, but just in terms of like dealing with DTOs, drug trafficking organizations,
right.
You don't think it's going to be much help?
No, I don't. And I think we have 10 years of evidence to show that. And the evidence that I'm talking about, a lot of it is publicly available evidence. I mean, some of it comes from my interviews, but most of it is out there
mm-hmm.
for anyone to look at. And I think we would agree that the country is not necessarily better than 10 years ago. And so, yes, well, it may be very flashy to send someone, you know, across the border, oh, he's just been extradited. Is that truly having an effect on these organizations? I don't think so. And I think the fact that they still operate and they're still making a profit proves
so it's just public opinion then. I mean, it's public opinion that's driving this, and it's public opinion that's going to accept this because of their fear of being in the streets of Michoacán or DF, even for that matter. She's shaking her head, yes.
Yes.
Well, that's not good because, I mean, that we're still left without a real strategy to deal with crime and organized crime in Mexico.
Right. So the bottom line of my research is an invitation to rethink precisely
mm-hmm.
security and how we think about organized crime. And so let's forget about these good versus bad approaches, you know, the idea of the drug lords, the kingpins. That's not really useful for us to really think about the problem. So
mm-hmm.
again, if we start, you know, looking at the differences and how they operate, how they punish people within their own organization, those things matter. These behavioral patterns, as I call them, matter for policy.
You don't even need cops on the street for that. It's intelligence.
Right. It doesn't necessarily have to be an invasive.
Yeah.
I mean, there's of course the need again for law enforcement.
Yeah.
But if you want to limit the activities of these organizations, there are other ways to tackle it.
You're not saying other ways. You're saying better ways or
yes.
ways that will actually probably work.
Be more fruitful.
More fruitful. Okay, Cecilia or Dr. Farfán, thank you very much for participating, for being with us today in the Security Perimeter Podcast. Hope to see you soon. Maybe you'll get a policy position somewhere in the federal government. Is that what you're looking for? No.
I'm a happy researcher.
You're a happy researcher. Yeah. Okay.
Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
Oh, it was great.